Good afternoon, you're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, government seeks to press ahead with a banking inquiry that leaves Anglo out. Can it be done? As the budget approaches with the promise of yet another round of spending cuts, do we know what we're in for? And the ASTI rejects the new pay deal, government pledges to hold firm. Will industrial action be the outcome? First the news with John Finnerty. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne, our first show of the new season. We're delighted to be back with you at 1 o'clock this and every Saturday, and we welcome your views on any of the topics we're going to cover on the programme. You can text us on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie. The Twitter address is at SaturdayRTE. And joining me first today are Dara Cailleary, Fianna Fáil TD and spokesperson on jobs, Pascal Donoghue, Fine Gael Minister of State for European Affairs, and Brian Dowling from RTE's political staff. And Brian, it's very pertinent that you're here because when I'm away on enforced leave, you'll be in this seat for a number of weeks.
That is the plan as I understand it, yeah. Claire. You know? So it'll be a different experience.
You're ready, are you? Yeah. You'll be on this side of the desk. And of course, it's very pertinent that we have the two of you here because we have Mayo and Dublin represented. And actually, we have tickets and no tickets represented as well, I understand.
Well, we're looking forward to a good two teams tomorrow.
Because you'll be there.
I'm hoping to be there, yeah. To our minor team and our senior team, best of luck. It's a very exciting weekend. The exodus began this morning as I was coming up this morning. The roads were busy. And it's just really, really exciting. Everybody, nerves are building all over the county.
Pascal, you'll be at home, will you?
I'll be at home. I mean, I live in Phibsborough, so it's right beside Croke Park. So the atmosphere is already building. We're looking forward to greeting all our friends and visitors from Mayo tomorrow. I won't be going myself. I don't have a ticket. I'll be watching it on the couch with the family. And I feel the need to state that publicly, given the number of people who've contacted me looking for a ticket over the last few weeks. If I was to say anything different, it'd be the end of me.
I was just going to say that everybody is being asked for tickets. And as politicians in particular, you must be asked all the time, can you get me a ticket? You've got a great answer, Pascal. You don't have one for yourself. So
yeah, it's the ultimate kind of credibility I can say to people. Because I don't have one for myself, I'm afraid I can't get one for anybody else.
Whereas you, Dara...
Well,
I'm a bit more trouble.
During the week, we had a lecture on localism in politics, and as part of our thinking. And as that was going on, I was getting text messages from people looking for All-Ireland tickets. So I didn't suggest to David Farrell that this was the biggest issue in Mayo, was All-Ireland tickets.
I think it is.
I'm sure he would have been horrified.
I've already heard two politicians choose their words with such care as we've done over the last few minutes.
Yeah. I think the downside for Pascal is that a lot of his constituents perhaps will be looking at him saying, you've become a minister, you don't have a ticket.
See?
Yeah.
Oh, well, look, I think it's a good strategy anyway to stay at home and then avoid the questions. And best of luck to both teams as somebody who's a neutral. Tomorrow. Now, to somebody who may or may not have tickets, economist Colm McCarthy's on the line. Colm, good afternoon to you. Thank you for joining us today. The reason we want to talk to you is because the banking inquiry, which we heard about this week, will not, it seems, look at Anglo at all until the criminal cases have been dealt with. Now, I know that you see the need for a bank inquiry for a number of reasons, but what do you think of what's happening now?
Well, it looks like it's going to be a parliamentary inquiry, and some people felt that wasn't the best type of inquiry to have, but that ship has sailed now. There's a couple of things that I think are quite important. It's important that the inquiry should reach back to the origins of the credit bubble. And there's a funny narrative going around that everything was fine until Lehman Brothers collapsed in October 2008, but of course the Irish credit bubble started in the late 1990s actually, when the banks started to give out mortgages more liberally and they started to lend to property speculators and so on.
Was that particular to Ireland, do you think?
It happened in other countries, but our inquiry is into what happened in Ireland, and I think it's important that on a bank-by-bank basis there should be an explanation for how the relaxation in lending standards arose within each bank. And the genesis of it was in the late 1990s, so I think it's important that the inquiry should reach back to that.
So do you think it can be done then, leaving Anglo aside, at least for a while?
Well, I'm coming to that. I also think that the inquiry needs to look at how it was dealt with when the crisis broke. And the crisis began to emerge really in 2007, and eventually things blew up in the autumn of 2008 when the infamous bank guarantee was extended and so on. I think it's important that those events are included. And also, I think it would be a pity if the time span of the inquiry ended then. I think the way in which we responded to it, we set up NAMA, there was a bank guarantee, eventually there was a recapitalization of the banks. There is evidence that inappropriate pressure was placed on successive Irish governments by the European Central Bank in paying off bondholders. So I think the inquiry should really stretch from the late 1990s up until fairly recently. I mean, not until yesterday, obviously, but until maybe 2012, so that the whole sequence of events is thoroughly inquired into.
Okay.
On the Anglo thing, clearly Anglo was a central part of it. It wasn't the only part. Every bank in the country went wallop. Clearly, the whole Anglo business needs to be included. But it may have to be left towards the end of the inquiry when the legal cases have been dealt with.
And will that work, do you think? Is that
well, I
feasible?
Think in a way, you know, the Oireachtas is on trial here. A lot of people have expressed scepticism, including some members of the Oireachtas, have expressed scepticism about whether a parliamentary inquiry will be sufficiently dispassionate so as to work properly. I think it can, but it will mean that everybody will have to focus narrowly on the task in hand. There have been parliamentary inquiries elsewhere, including the committee that was headed by an MP called Andy Tyrie in the UK, and they managed to avoid the temptations of political partisanship and so on, and to try and inquire systematically and produce a very good report. So I don't think it's impossible that the Oireachtas can produce a good report.
But in a smaller pool where you've got a situation where most people, most parliamentarians, have said something about the banks and may have to be therefore excluded, it looks more and more difficult to get to the point where you would have enough people to sit on such an Oireachtas committee. Shane Ross during the week suggested that perhaps an independent person should chair it, like Matthew Elderfield, he suggested, in the same way that George Mitchell did for the peace process. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I don't know whether that's possible. I mean, the decision seems to have been taken. Your guests on the panel will be able to answer this better than I can. It seems to me the government has said it's going to be a parliamentary inquiry. It's not going to be an inquiry headed by a judge or anything like that. There's a couple of things, though, that I'd just like to add quickly. There's no point asking 8 or 10 Dáil deputies who have lots of other things to do to conduct what will be a lengthy and very detailed and technical inquiry unless they are properly resourced. So this committee has to be given a decent budget. It has to be given backup staff. They'll need accountants and financial experts and so on, because the people that they will be interviewing will arrive in with busloads of lawyers, as we all know, and the committee will need to be thoroughly well resourced. One small final point. Because we've had a banking disaster, people have tend to forget that we also had a big insurance company failure, namely Quinn Insurance, which went bust because of under-reserving and so on. And while we're at it, we may as well inquire into that. If that had happened on its own and there hadn't been a banking disaster, it would have been a major scandal on its own. So I think the opportunity is there to include that failure, which also involved regulatory failures, as of course did the banking collapse.
Colm, stay with us if you can. Brian, just to come to you on this one point that Colm raised there about the politics of this, that if you have 8 to 10 parliamentarians, they'll have to spend all of their time on this and they'll have to be briefed and resourced properly. But that means they neglect the business of politics and perhaps their constituencies. Who would want the job?
Oh, I think there will be no shortage of takers for the job, because I think any politician across the board in Leinster House would see this as an opportunity to take part in an inquiry which essentially would raise their own profile. The big difficulty might be, first of all, to avoid grandstanding. And the real difficulty is the legislation under which this inquiry would be conducted has two very explicit provisions. One relates to the issue of the perception of bias. So any politician who said anything in the past or who wrote anything in the past that in any way suggests they have a prejudicial view will find it difficult and cannot be a member of the committee.
That's just about everybody then.
Well, most politicians have expressed views of one kind or another. The other point is that the legislation also has a section dealing with legal redress. And this essentially arose from the defeat of the referendum to allow an Oireachtas committee to have wider powers. Mm. And this was included in this legislation. So there's an explicit process for legal redress for anyone who felt that they were not getting a fair hearing at any inquiry that might be set up. Now, given, if you look at the range of people who might be involved in this inquiry, both individual bankers, the banks themselves, state institutions, former politicians, we know from the past, there's a long history in this country that people are not slow to seek redress into courts if they feel that their constitutional rights to a fair hearing are being compromised in any fashion. So in that sense, the people conducting the inquiry will be walking on eggshells from day one. How do you then decouple or park away a big element, which is the Anglo-Irish issue? Because the Anglo-Irish issue does cut across many of the other issues. If you take, the government has said this would, in their view, have three modules. The first one, the events leading up to the bank guarantee. It is possible that that might include the look back that Colm referred to, but we don't know what the starting point is. How far back do we go? If it's on a shorter timescale, in the weeks leading up to the bank guarantee, we know as a matter of public record, in the final days leading up to the bank guarantee, there were contacts between all the main banks, including Anglo, amongst themselves and between the government at various levels. So how do you pull Anglo from that? How do you deal with that issue?
And if you do that, and if you leave the Anglo module, if you like, until the very end, this government has 2.5 years left to run. So if you get to the point where you're at election time and some members of that committee perhaps are not elected representatives by the time we get to report issuing stage, how does that work?
That's another issue. And if you look at the time frame, when might this start? Well, if the committee is set up, let's say, before this side of Christmas, presumably it will need a number of weeks, if not a few short months, to gather whatever paper, documents, witness statements they need to gather in the first instance to prepare a schedule for the inquiry. My understanding is that the trials in relation to the Anglo issue are scheduled for January. Now, that may or may not hold, depending on whether the books of evidence are ready. I assume if they went ahead in January, it might be better politically, because it means then that they would be dealt with presumably in a matter of weeks or a few months, which would clear the way to do the whole inquiry. But if the trials are delayed or put back, that means that you really can't deal with the Anglo issue.
If there are appeal situations, there's any number of things that could happen.
Just even that we see with a lot of big complex trials where the book of evidence, there's additions to it, there's revisions as we go along, and that may happen in this case or it may not happen. Mm-hmm. So I find it difficult to see how large portions of this inquiry could proceed in advance of the trials taking place.
Okay.
Even if the trials are on a narrow ground of particular alleged offences, nonetheless, the people involved would be central to some of the other issues, like the ones Colm mentioned about the lending practices, about how mortgages were so freely given, the scale of the mortgages. They're still central to that.
The busloads of lawyers that Colm referred to might have something to say about it. Pascal, it looks pretty difficult to do this, doesn't it? Riven with problems.
Sure. I mean, I'm struck by a phrase that Brian used there regarding the business of politics. And it would appear to me that a core part of the business of politics that we have now is to be able to establish what happened and why. We're talking about a banking...
Why should politicians have that? Be given that job, though?
Well, we've had other people involved in doing the job so far to date. We've had a Honan report, we've had a Reglin and Watson report, we've had a report by Nyberg all into us. So other people have looked at it. In direct answer to your question regarding why politicians should do it, I'd suggest there's two reasons. Firstly, politics should be at the core of how we govern our country and how we move forward. It's clear that we have big questions to answer about that. We can see how politicians in other countries have been extremely successful at answering these questions. We should be able to do it here. The second reason why it should be done in this way is, despite all the reports that have been done, there are still many questions that are unanswered. There's three questions in particular that we need to drill into that are at the heart of the difficulty we faced. Firstly, what happened in relation to corporate governance that led to the kind of lending policies that we saw? Secondly, what was the role of internal and external auditors across that period? And thirdly, what was the role of the financial regulator and the Department of Finance, and the lack of distinction between a liquidity crisis, in other words, banks running out of money, and a solvency crisis, where they nearly went bust?
That's all very valid what you say, but you've got to talk about Anglo in isolation at some point down the line and deal with the other banks first? It just seems very, very difficult, almost impossible to do that.
I would respectfully disagree. I mean, the reason why the difficulties and collapse of Anglo Irish Bank have to be left till later is because as vital as it is to do this work, it should not get in the way of the criminal justice system. What we're talking about here is an investigation into bodies as opposed to the accountability of individuals, which is what criminal justice does. If this work was to proceed...
Because this inquiry can't make findings
exactly.
against individuals.
I mean, imagine if this was to go ahead and it was to lead to a collapse of criminal proceedings in relation to individuals that will be in court in the new year. That would be a disaster for everybody concerned. The second reason why I think it's appropriate to leave Anglo Irish to later on in the investigation, not to mention this point, is because there was vast difficulties that also cost huge money to the taxpayer in relation to other banks, Bank of Ireland, Allied Irish Bank, all that has to be looked into as well.
I just wonder whether it's possible, though, to do it in isolation. Colin McCarthy, just to come back to you before we come to Dara Cleary, would it not be an idea to leave the entire inquiry until the criminal trials have been dealt with and then we can look at it in the round?
Well, I think there are certain things that can go ahead before we get round to Anglo. For example, it's a fact that the banks in Ireland, until the 1990s, had a reputation for being fairly cautious and conservative in their lending practices. Now, bearing in mind that every single bank got into trouble, including the foreign-owned banks, it's clear that something changed towards the end of the 1990s. The banks decided, perhaps because they had readier access to interbank money because of Ireland joining the euro and so on, and because the economy had had a very good run, the banks, instead of being the first line of defence against a credit bubble, the line cracked and we had a credit bubble, and the regulators subsequently failed to do anything about it as well. Now, I think there's plenty of work that could usefully be done, and I think Pascal was hinting at this, in just looking at what happened in those years, 1999, 2000, 2001, up to 2003 or 4, within each bank. How did they begin to expand their balance sheets at such a rapid rate? How did the looser lending standards and collateral standards emerge? I think all of that work could be done before you start getting into the nuts and bolts of Anglo. And don't forget that Anglo was a very special bank. It didn't have a branch network around the country. It didn't have a lot of retail business. It didn't have people with checking accounts and stuff. It was a specialist bank which went wallop. It lost nearly half of its loan book, lending money mainly into the property bubble. So I think that could safely be left until later. Obviously, if the criminal trials drag on forever, that's a problem. But the criminal trials, as I understand it, are expected to take a matter of perhaps a few months.
Dara, where do you stand on this? Do you think we can get on with a certain amount of work, as Colm says, before we need to even mention Anglo in all of this?
We welcome the inquiry and we're looking forward to it. We've no difficulty with it. I think Colm has set out some very good background there that could be looked at. But the prospect of looking at a banking inquiry in any stage while excluding a key player in that inquiry, it's going to weaken the inquiry. And secondly, you know, our main problem is the prospect of a political-led inquiry. It will be partisan-led. This is the most partisan government in many years.
Oh, that's the other big deal here as well, that the proposal is to look at it up until the bank guarantee, not, as Colm says, up to last year, which he thinks
well,
would be a
well, that's the other issue, Claire. I mean, the issue came in and made the announcement and then there was no detail. So the announcement was grand. It got all the coverage and it got them through day one of the opening day of the Oireachtas. That came the story, but there was actually very little detail behind it. Mm-hmm. So that kind of specific detail we want a discussion on. But the notion of doing a political-led inquiry led by politicians in this particular Dáil and with this particular government is flawed. This is a very partisan government. What we have proposed all along since the beginning of the summer is an inquiry similar to Levinson in the UK, which looked into media activities there. You can get an international judge. There is statute on the books, Tribunal of Inquiry Act, which would control the costs of that and let it proceed in an independent, non-partisan manner. And the issues that Colm has raised there, you know, I think there's actually a lot of really sense to it, and there's a lot of sense to going back to the 1999 period But if you do that in the Levinson-style model, you're more likely to get answers of fact rather than answers of politics.
Pascal, it does seem sensible.
I just find it extraordinary that when Fianna Fáil have a few posters up demanding that the Dáil get more power and more reform, when the government puts in place a procedure to allow that Dáil to have more power and more reform, they're against it. That's the reality of what's happening here. This is an this will be led by the Dáil for the reasons we've talked about. Dara and his party leader have spent the last few weeks saying the Dáil needs to have more power. The moment that power is given to the Dáil, they're against it.
The Dáil is a creature
of
government of
what's
moment,
going to be happening here.
This is
it's very clear.
The
House of the Oireachtas Inquiry Act was signed by the President on the 24th of July. It will be enacted by Minister Howland on the 25th of September. It will then be up to the very Dáil that Dara is looking to have more power and more independence to then make use of the powers to which it will be granted.
Okay, quick response, Dara, and then Brian.
The Dáil is a creature of this government at the moment, especially of this government. And what they want is an inquiry that will be another creature of Fine Gael and Labour. We want an inquiry that gives answers to what happened, and the Levinson model is the way to pursue it.
Brian, you want to come back in
there? I think the real test, Claire, of how impartial this inquiry will be, we will see that when the actual detailed terms of reference are worked out. Essentially,
when are we going to see that, by the way? Do we have any indication?
I think that's going to take a few weeks. What the Taoiseach did the other evening was he gave three broad headings as to what the inquiry should look at. Mm-hmm. One is the events leading up to the bank guarantee, the banks and their auditors, and then the role of state institutions. But he did say, in fairness, that it would be a matter for the parties and for the Dáil to work out the detail of that. And I do think it will fall to the parties themselves to work out the actual detailed terms of reference in some form of negotiation. And I would imagine that if some people are not happy with that, if Fianna Fáil are not happy with other people, well, then there's going to be real difficulty getting this off the ground in the first place.
The difficulty today, Claire, is when the government says we will negotiate the other parties, it happened with Pascal's Dáil reforms. The government said we'd have the Taoiseach said at the end of the summer, we'll chat about Dáil reforms. The Dáil reforms were published without any consultation with anybody in the House, Ken Carter included. It'll be the same with the tribunals, with this bank inquiry. They'll come up with the terms of reference, they'll publish them. And if we thought there was going to be a real discussion, we want this inquiry to proceed. We want to proceed and we will work with it fully, but not on the basis of a Fine Gael Labour agenda.
The public just need to listen to this. Again, the Fianna Fáil are spending the last few weeks saying the Dáil needs more power. We give the Dáil more power. They're against that as well.
Okay. All right, we're going to leave that one there. Colm McCarthy, thank you very much for joining us on the phone today. And we'll say goodbye to Colm now. There's one thing before we move on that I want to address. The costs of the abolition of the Seanad and what happened over the last 24 hours. The finance officer from the Oireachtas saying that the savings can't be estimated once we get rid of the Seanad. So while that person is saying that it could be 20 million in terms of what we're spending on it on an annual basis, they can't say that we would save 20 million if we got rid of it. So that makes those posters that are everywhere, the Fine Gael posters, wrong. You can't validate what is being said on those posters, Pascal.
No, they're correct, Claire. I mean,
But the finance officer is telling us that they're not.
Could you just allow me just quickly to answer the question? I mean, I think we do need a bit of consistency in relation to this. We've had the last number of months, the people who are campaigning against the government have been saying the Seanad doesn't cost 20 million euro to run. We had the individual come out yesterday and say it does cost 20 million to run. The people who've been saying that that figure is incorrect are now saying that if we remove an institution that costs 20 million to run, we won't save that. It was validated very clearly yesterday that it costs 20 million euro. If the people vote to abolish it, and Dara was correct in saying that, we have a referendum underway in it.
But you've got to be very honest and clear here. And I just want to tell people what the finance officer said. You've got to have a strong caveat attached to the 20 million euro savings figure as it relates to the costs, but it may not translate fully into savings in the event that the Seanad is being abolished.
And if the people do vote to abolish the Seanad, bear in mind we've spent the last number of weeks with people saying the Seanad doesn't cost 20 million euro to run. If the people do vote to abolish it, the government will pursue those 20
those,
million euro saving and we will deliver
it. Pascal, those posters, we've all seen them. We've all
save
driven past
million.
Them. They say it's save 20 million. And the finance officer from the Oireachtas is saying that's not going
to
it's unlikely to happen.
I mean, with respect, there's no lie there. And I mean, I think, once we get into a debate like this as we are, if the best the opponents can do is accuse us of lying, then we don't have a very good two weeks ahead of us.
We'd love Pascal to have a debate, but the Taoiseach won't
repeat,
debate.
Again, he said the Seanad cost 20 million euro to run. If the people vote, I spent 2.5 hours yesterday out canvassing in Carber for the Seanad. Across that time, I met one person who's able to vote for us. It's an institution that has been unreformed, that's unelected by the majority of people here in Ireland. And that's why we're campaigning for its abolition.
Dara.
And if the people vote accordingly, we will deliver those savings.
Dara.
The figures are a lie. You're not going to save 20 million. What we are calling is a referendum commission to actually clarify this for once and for all. If Fine Gael are so sure of their case in relation to it, well, why won't the leader of the party debate it in a proper form? Debate it with other people, with Micheál Martin or other people, debate it here in RTE in a non-partisan manner. The Taoiseach is running away from that debate. And, you know, Pascal was happy to use the Seanad for 3.5 years as his launching pad for his career now. And, you know, what we're saying is reform it, change it. What we need, and we need more oversight, absolutely.
Okay, but I don't want to get into the Seanad debate as such, and I know that both of you are keen to, but it was particularly on that 20 million euro figure that we wanted to focus today. Brian, is that a game changer? Does it matter to people, do you think?
I think the main debate around the Seanad will still continue, but I think there has been a huge focus on the 20 million figure, and I think the letter that emerged yesterday from the finance officer of the Oireachtas does move it into a different territory, and I think it is a setback on the government side or on the yes side, because it is an explicit statement. The letter says you cannot estimate the net actual savings, and it goes on to say, to quote you read, that you have to have a strong caveat around 20 million figure because it is a cost figure, and it's the finance officer says it may not translate into savings. Now I can see where the government's coming saying they're saying we will still achieve those savings if it is abolished, and it depends how you do it, because when you look at the 20 million figure, the breakdown given by the finance officer is that 2 million of this relates to pensions. 9.3 million of this relates to the support costs in the Seanad, which are IT costs, the superintendent, ancillary staff. 8.8 million is directly attributable to senators' salaries, expenses and the staff that they employ.
OK, so you can't just go in there and fire everybody who works as a
support. The question is, how do you make the 20 million savings? Mm. How do you actually make it? Where do you get that from? What changes to give you the 20 million? If only 8.8 million is directly attributable to salaries, expenses and direct support staff for senators.
Well, look, we have 2 more weeks to talk about all of this and we're going to be talking about it a lot over the next fortnight, so we're going to leave that one there. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be finding out what's likely to happen with pupils and schools as the ASTI vote down the new pay agreement.
RTE Radio 1.
You're very welcome back to Saturday with Claire Byrne. Now, the first person we're going to talk to in this part of the programme is Martin Wall, industry correspondent with the Irish Times, on the news that the ASTI has rejected the terms of the Haddington Road Agreement. And it looks as though government are going to hold firm. So where do we go from here? Martin, you're very welcome to the programme. So first of all, tell us what happened with that ASTI vote and what it means.
Well, good afternoon, Claire. Well, basically, the members of the ASTI, secondary school teachers, they followed the advice of their union leadership and they voted by 2-1 against the Haddington Road proposals to save 300 million euro in pay costs this year and a billion over 3 years. They're the only public service trade union so far who have voted against it, and they look, as of now, in a rather isolated place. There's only one other union that's still outstanding, the university teachers, university lecturers. Their ballot is due on Monday, but as things stand at the moment, the ASTI are in a rather isolated place. They're on their own and in opposition to Haddington Road. And it looks at this stage that the government is now going to impose fairly draconian legislation, which it passed in July, and going to impose pay cuts on members of the ASTI. So that seems to be the position as we stand at the moment.
This is the FEMPI legislation, but it sounds as though it might be very difficult to do that, because you've got to find out exactly who's in ASTI and who isn't in ASTI, punish them and not the others.
Yeah, one of the key difficulties from yesterday was that the members of the Teachers Union of Ireland, another teaching union, voted to accept the Haddington Road deal. So now the administrative difficulties for the government is that members of the ASTI, members of the TOI serving in the same schools, and also teachers who are members of no unions, and what does the government actually do in relation to it? because one of the issues under this new legislation is, as a result of the legislation, is it looks like that members of the ASTI are going to have their incremental pay increases. That's the pay increase that they that teachers receive virtually every year as they move along this, their career progression along the scale. That is going to be frozen for 3 years for members of the ASTI. The TUI, for example, on the other hand, they will receive the increments that's the forthcoming increment, and then those will be delayed. So the issue then is, the likelihood now is that the government is going to have to go to the TUI, ask them for lists of their members for payment of this increment, but members of the ASTI, and more interestingly, people who are members of no union, will not know who they are, and therefore the people who are members of no union could also be affected by this. So there's a whole load of administrative difficulties that flow from this as well. In addition to the big difficulty, obviously, is the potential issue of disruption in schools as the ASTI respond to the imposition of cuts by the government.
Well, it sounds very messy from an administrative point of view. But as you say, the real impact for a wider group of people, pupils and parents, will be industrial action, prospect of any industrial action. What's likely to happen first, do you think, Martin?
Well, there's the standing committee, the committee that deals with day-to-day issues for the ASTI, is meeting on Monday, and it will decide at that meeting, or will consider at that meeting, how will it respond now? What will it do? Members have voted, as well as rejecting Haddington Road, they voted for industrial action, so they're going to have to presumably do something. There was a menu of options given to teachers when they balloted. They could issue such as work. They could introduce a work to rule. They could refuse to cooperate with education initiatives. And there's a whole raft of education initiatives have been put forward by Rory Quinn as minister. They could abandon the productivity measures that were agreed under the original Crow Park agreements. For example, teachers had to work an additional 33 hours per year, provided they could abandon that, or they could move towards issues like work stoppages. So the industrial relations observers yesterday were suggesting that the likelihood was, as a starting point, that maybe the issues like the Crow Park productivity measures, the 33 hours, they may withdraw from that. But that itself could have difficulties because that 33 hours over the year was used for planning purposes and whatever outside of tuition time. If that's moved back into tuition time because of any ban by the ASTI, well, that could impact on teaching time also as well. So
there is another option. There is renegotiation. Is that likely to happen? I said earlier on that the government looks as though it's holding firm. Do you agree?
All the indications from government sources last night were that there was absolutely no prospect of a renegotiation. For one very simple reason, Haddington Road embraced about 300,000 people across the public service, from Gardaí to nurses to teachers to members of the defence forces, civil servants, local authority workers, HSE staff, etc. Very, very few, if anybody, in the public service likes the Haddington Road agreement. The danger for the government, as they see it, would be is that any form of renegotiation would run the risk of unpicking the entire edifice of it, as other groups would immediately seek to try change elements of the deal that they didn't like. Now, for example, one of the first people you'd imagine would be nurses, for example. About 40,000 nurses who are facing additional working hours, things that there is really, really a difficult issue for them, given that they went on strike several years ago to try and have their working week reduced. Mm-hmm. Now it's being increased again under Haddington Road. So I think if there was, as the government see it, if there was any form of leeway of renegotiation to try bring the ASTI on board, the danger was that other groups would look also for areas of difficulties that they have with it, and the whole edifice could potentially unravel.
A huge can of worms. Martin, thank you very much for joining us today. That's Martin Wall. We're joined in studio now by Marie Sherlock, SIPTU economist. Marie, what do you make of all of that? I mean, the government really hold all of the cards here, as you heard Martin saying, renegotiation probably not an option. So we're looking at disruption and a very difficult time for teachers because they're going to have to be isolated from other teachers and so on when it comes to the punishment that may be meted out.
Well, Claire, certainly, I suppose, as Martin pointed out there, we're very much in uncharted waters in terms of trying to, single out those who have accepted the agreement and those who have rejected. As Martin said, the executive of the ASTI will be meeting next week and will obviously make a decision then as to what to do. But the thing is that there was a democratic decision taken here. Every union who was in those negotiations, you know, took a democratic ballot and you know, the vast majority have signed up to that. And beyond that, I think it's probably premature to be speculating as to what the consequences might be at this point in time. There is huge issues there for the Department of Education and for the teaching unions, but we just have to wait and see.
OK, all right, we're going to leave that one there because another quick break now, and then we're going to be talking all about the budget.
RTE Radio 1.
This is Saturday with Claire Byrne. In the studio today, I'm joined by Dara Cleary, Fianna Fáil TD, Fine Gael Minister of State for European Affairs, Pascal Donoghue, SIPTU economist Marie Sherlock and Chambers Ireland representative Sean Murphy is with us as well. Now, the budget is on the way in just a couple of weeks and the focus has been on whether there will be an adjustment of 3.1 billion this year or slightly less. And much has been made of Labour wanting the figure to be lower, Fine Gael still deciding where it wants it to be. But the reality away from the bartering is that everyone in the state is likely to feel the brunt of it after years of austerity. And that's really the point, Pascal, isn't it? That regardless of whether it's 2.7 or 2.8 or 3.1, it's still going to be very tough.
It is going to be a tough budget, absolutely. And it will come on the top of the fact that over the last number of years, the people of Ireland have delivered nearly 28 billion euro worth of saving. They're all wondering when this is going to end. And it's important to remember that across that period, a year and a half ago, if our country was trying to borrow money to pay for schools, to pay for hospitals, to pay for the kind of issues we were talking about earlier on, it would have cost Ireland around 15% to borrow money. It now costs us 4% to borrow money. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that is so important to all of our future is the lower that figure is, that means the more tax that comes in, the more we can spend it on things people care about. And we can unfortunately never take that for granted, Claire, because there's many other countries across Europe, including some countries that are in bailout programmes, that are seeing those interest rates go up and up and up. And what that means is the difficulty that they're enduring. They face a situation where any money they have coming in, a lot of it is eaten up with interest payments on debt they've incurred. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're desperately working hard to avoid happening. And okay, that's where the sacrifice of the Irish people have got us to.
But as I heard Brendan Keenan from The Independent saying recently, you might be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel, but you've got to struggle uphill still to get there.
Yes.
And you had said on RTE's The Week in Politics that there might be a bit of leeway on the 3.1 billion. Do you still think that's the case?
Well, I learned a lesson from that programme I did. what I was trying to say at the time here is there was technical possibilities and everything. But what I should have made clear at the time, and I appreciate you asking me the question again, was that what the government wants to do is we want to ensure that we can exit the bailout programme, and we want to ensure that once we get out, we stay out. We were the second Eurozone country to go into a programme. We want to be the first to leave. And what will allow us to do that is that the interest rates that we have to pay for our schools and hospitals, to keep that figure as low as possible. And that's what we need to do that.
So the party line now is we stick to the 3.1.
Well,
until we get to budget day and then you'll pull it back a little bit.
I mean, with respect, Claire, the party line, particularly for Minister Noonan, has always been to say we absolutely have to hit our deficit figure. And in order to ensure that, we believe the figure we need to deliver is to get a deficit figure that begins with 4%.
Okay.
Because there's all kinds of difficulties within the world economy across Europe. We've made huge progress to get to this point, and we do not want to ensure that progress is now lost.
Sean, can I come to you on this? Do you think the numbers matter, tinkering around the edges of 3.1 billion?
Well, I think in a state that's spending the guts of 50 odd billion euro, it's relatively small. And if you put it in context, the cost over on the HSE last year in the emergency budget was 300 million euro. So like our view would be if government could keep its costs within its actual parameters, and specifically entities such as the HSE could live within the envelope that's been set aside for them, we'd be in a much better place. I think a lot of people would say that the tax return numbers for September, we're not going to know them till early October, would be fairly crucial, because you're going to have the VAT returns on what we're all hoping and everybody is saying and everybody's seeing was a very positive summer. A lot of domestic spend, uptick in tourism, our foreign direct investment base is still staying strong. And that upturn, which we're hoping for, summer and the first week in October should hopefully give a little bit more leeway to government in terms of what it has to do.
It's very much up to the wire, though, because that has become a universal theme. I think both Fianna Fáil and government are saying, let's wait and see what the October Exchequer returns are like. That's pretty close to D-Day.
But it's a good thing that D-Day is in October. Like, that's really, really good from the point of view of Christmas sentiment, you know. And in fact, even the referendum is really good because it's not going to be a whole lot of people warning and caning the population about how bad the budget's going to be because we're talking about the referendum. The point is, exactly. No, but the point is, in terms of consumer
sentiment, it's not going to go away though if we try to ignore it.
I think what really will get things going ultimately is when consumers and we all in this domestic economy start spending money. And there are people out there with money who have been involved in very heavy precautionary saving. And with a bit more confidence, you'd be surprised how quickly you get the buoyancy in terms of VAT and activity levels and ultimately jobs in service industries and retail and everything else in the future in this domestic economy.
I wonder who those people are with all the money. I mean, it's not that... The mortgaged generation, is it?
No, I mean, the particularly heavily mortgaged, if you look at most recent ESRI figures, are the 35s to 44s. Mm-hmm. But there's a large number of people, especially those over 50, who have little or almost no mortgage. And, you know, a lot of them are involved in heavy precautionary saving because they've been frightened out of their wits. So, you know, a little less kite flying, a little more focus on saying there is certainty, no more tax increases, no more increases in employment costs. And suddenly you could get the new bathroom, the new kitchen, from which government would get, you know, 23% spend in terms of our VAT, in terms of the luxury spend.
So where do we get the money from then?
Well, ultimately, it's buoyancy. That's our view. Ultimately, it's buoyancy in terms of increased taxes through VAT and circulation of money. The real way you do it is by containing cost spending, and that's in particular things like the HSE. I think, personally, I was really disappointed that it got emergency funding of €300 million last year. You know, it's employing 130,000 staff.
It's going to happen again.
Well, why should it happen again? This is our point. Why should it happen again? It should be living within its envelope. Absolutely. Sick leave in HSE, still not good enough. You know, the level of waste in there. A senior person in the policy sphere told me recently, or said to me recently, if you put €1 billion into the HSE or you took €1 billion out, would anybody notice?
For God's sake, if you look at what the HSE has gone through over the last number of years, I mean, its staff is down by 10%, its funding is down by 20%. And despite the huge efforts that have been made to keep public services in place, it's had a huge impact on the people working in the service, not to mention the people who are receiving the services. I mean, I've got the Mater Hospital in my constituency and I see the gigantic efforts the staff go to try and deliver the kind of care they want despite the financial circumstances that we're in. And the alternative to money being put in to meet the kind of urgent need that we're talking about is more difficulty for people. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason why all this has happened is despite everything that's gone on the economy, we may have created an extra 34,000 jobs over the last 12 months and we've so further to go, but the number of medical cards has gone up as well.
I know, but it's just interesting that you have, on the one hand, James Riley saying, look, 65 billion could be the figure. It looks as though it could be a lot more because there are other issues there to be considered and some say that it could be an overrun of up to 200 million again this year. And in the same breath, he's saying, well, we're still looking at free GP care for young children. It just doesn't seem to balance out or to be sensible even.
I think that's probably the big issue in the health services. The minister hasn't enough command of his own department. I think Sean is wrong just to throw out a figure. Would you notice a billion euro figure?
I'd take it back. It was flippant.
You would. And yeah. I think Pascal is also, one of the difficulties in health budgeting is the amount of demand-led schemes that are there. But the minister isn't in charge of his department. That is a big issue in terms of trying to control expenditure. But even where you have positives, you know, we have the capital budget. You know, the capital budget was an underspent last year by €145 million. The government actually had an envelope to spend on capital projects. They underspent it. That equates to about 2,000 jobs that could have been created. The employment figures that Pascal just mentioned, we've had a growth of about 30,000. That is to be welcomed. Much of it is in part-time. It includes 11,000 jobs in the tourism and hospitality sector. And Minister Noonan came out last night and said that one of the planks of that growth, of that employment growth, the 9% VAT rate, is going to go up to 13.5%. So that's going to immediately put the potential to create more jobs there. This budget needs to be about jobs. Every cent that's spent on this budget, we need to see, well, what will that maintain a job, or more importantly, will it create a job? Mm-hmm. We have 400,000 people who are signing on every week. And academic discussions about, you know, 5.1, 3.1, that's what it means to them, to their ability to get a job. Yeah. That's what the difference is.
Marie-Shar, that's pretty much what you guys are saying at SIPTU as well, that you've got to invest and you've got to create jobs. But you're looking for 4.1. €5 billion in stimulus investment.
Yes, to be rolled out over the next 3 years. But Claire, I just want to come back to the point about health spending here. Sean makes the point about buoyancy in the economy and trying to reinstill confidence. And, you know, OK, maybe the comment was glib about taking €1 billion out of the health service and you wouldn't notice. But the key thing is that with the health service, notwithstanding all the difficulties, it's local suppliers, it's people, it's small businesses in Ireland that are feeding in to the, and of course people from abroad who are feeding into the health service, right? So if you're to have a massive cut overnight, then who's that going to affect?
And the key issue, but if you have a budget for anything, for be it a business or a government department, and you're overrunning every year, there's something
wrong. Don't get me
wrong,
Claire, of course there has to be huge reforms within how the health budget is spent. And at the moment we have a situation, an explosion problem waiting to explode in terms of our nursing homes and the thousands of beds that, you know, if HICWA were to come in the morning, they would shut them down because they're not fit for purpose. So there's more money needs to go into the health budget, not less, but it needs to be better allocated. Mm-hmm. But the key issue with regards to budget 2014 is that we're at a very critical stage at the moment. We're talking about the figures going down to the wire and whatever. We know from last Thursday's figures that the Irish economy is still in a very fragile position. There's tentative signs of stabilisation, but it is still very fragile. The domestic economy is still stagnating. And if we are going to bring in a budget which has somewhere close to €1.9 billion in cuts, which is currently the proposal on the table, that is going to deflate the economy further. That is going to reduce the scope for buoyancy for the businesses that Sean, Chambers Ireland represent. And that is going to have a huge impact on the medium term recovery of the Irish economy.
So run us through then what your solution is. Tax the rich, tax the wealthy.
Well, so it's not as blunt or as crude as that. We are talking about a €2 billion budget, so much less than the €3.1 billion that's currently on the table. The Irish government is in a unique position in that it, for the first time in this crisis, it actually has spare capacity because of the promissory note deal earlier this year. And we're saying that, you know, that affords the government some space in terms of reducing the money, the cuts that are currently on the table.
George Lee spoke to an official from the European Central Bank this morning who said the government has got to stick to the plan here, and you can't be looking at €2 billion.
The key point, right, is that if we actually have a budget, right, that is focused on the areas where there is room at the top, where there is spare capacity in the tax system to be restructured and to get out additional money, and I'll go into those proposals in a second.
The ESRI, the Fiscal Advisory Council, everybody is saying we've got to stick to €3.1 billion.
And if you let me finish, right, so if we have a smaller budget plus a much bigger investment programme than what we currently have on the table, and a bring forward of the 7-year programme that was announced last year, we can actually begin to start taking people off the live register, creating jobs and meet our target. Colleagues of mine in the Nevin Economic Research Institute have, you know, done the projection, have looked at the current €3.1 billion budget proposal and actually find that the deficit will be 3.8% by 2015, okay, not the 3% as we need to. Our proposal actually gets
to the
3%.
I'm just wondering where you're going to find all of this money.
So where is it?
Pascal, is it possible? Is it possible? We're just up against it.
Claire, whatever savings the promissory note deal delivers, and we believe it will, we will use that funding to put in place to create new jobs. We're borrowing €1 billion We are borrowing €1 billion per month at the moment to close the gap between our spending and taxation. It's €12 billion this year. A few years ago, it was €20 billion. The Irish people have endured unimaginable sacrifice up to this point. And the reason why we want to get the deficit figure to where it is, to get us out of this bailout programme, is to ensure that the tax revenue that's coming in will be able to pay for job creation, like building Grange Gorman, building the new Lewis line. And what the promissory note deal will allow us to do is ensure we can invest money in those programmes.
Sean Murphy.
Yeah, just to say, Burr, we would have commonality with SIPTU in particular would be in terms of focusing on frontline services and frontline workers. And that's, you know, that's a given in terms of what we would prioritise, be it local government or the health service. But the issue is, are there more economies of scale? Are there more opportunities in terms of mergers, in terms of saving costs in the back office? And we think there are very significant sums there. Talk about increasing income taxes. Like the top 20%, which in this PAYE, PRSI workers, those earning over 100K, pay 70% odd of USC PRSI and PAYE. 70%. That's a very significant
sum. And on top of that, of course, it's a very significant sum. But my point is,
in terms of raising taxes by 1.9 billion euro, I didn't interrupt you, raising taxes by 1.9 billion euro, that's actually taking further money out of the economy. In terms of, if we're not talking about cutting pay, we're not talking about cutting salaries, we're talking about achieving more with the service money we have in place. And there's ways of doing that that actually can give you much better outputs under the Haddington Road and everything else. And that's where we should be going.
Claire, can I give you an example, right, of a measure, right, that, you know, has the potential to raise well in excess of 100 million euros and would not hurt high-income earners very much. At the moment, within our tax system, we have anybody who is in employment receives a personal tax credit, and if you're a PAYE worker, you receive a PAYE tax credit, €1,650 each, okay? Now, that is very useful for a low or medium, middle-income earner, but for a high-income earner, to have that effective subsidy to offset against their tax liability, you know, why should we have that there? We should withdraw it for those who are over 100,000 euros, because and that is a relatively painless measure.
We're coming close to the end, Derek Leary.
Your pastor talks about people making sacrifices. People have made huge sacrifices, but ultimately this budget is about the 400,000 people who are signing on either because they're unemployed or underemployed. This is a budget for them. This is a budget that has to give employment creators a chance to make jobs, those in jobs to save the jobs, and that the government actually spends the money, the capital budget, and increases the capital budget to create jobs. If we have jobs, we have buoyancy.
Okay, we've got to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us, Marie Sherlock and Sean Murphy, Pascal Donoghue, Derek Leary, and all of our other guests across the last hour. We're back here next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, and if you are going to that match, Dara and Sean, enjoy it, and the rest of us will be have prime position on the sofa. Take care. Bye bye.
Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The researcher was Richie Byrne, the broadcast coordinator Louise Denver, and sound supervision today was by Cara O'Hare.